For over 11 years, Frontline Fellowship has taken the gospel to the war zones of Africa. But on Sunday, the 25th of July, the war zones came to us.
On Sunday evening, July the 25th, the anti-Christian nature of the revolution in South Africa manifested itself in a new and deadly way when five terrorists from the Pan-African Congress bombed and strafed the largest evangelical church in Cape Town. Peter Hammond, director of Frontline Fellowship, was there and sends the following report.
At about 7:30 p.m. on Sunday the 25th of July, while a congregation of 1,500 listened to a hymn of worship, a group of gunmen burst into the church and opened fire with automatic weapons. This terrorist attack happened in Cape Town at the St. James Church, and it left 11 people dead and over 50 wounded.
I caught a movement at the front door on the side of the stage, and I suddenly saw this figure in blue, and etched against him was a big rifle, and I puzzled me because I thought we hadn't planned anything like this as a, you know, there's no drama or anything on, and but suddenly when the shots started coming, I realized this was for real.
Another eyewitness described it this way: I saw this man kick open the door next to the stage, and holding his rifle from the hip, he opened up on us, spraying bullets across a wide arc into the packed congregation. But before he even opened fire, two other black men who seemed to be wearing some olive green uniforms lobbed two hand grenades into the center of the church. There was this trail of smoke from the grenades, and a few puffs of smoke from the few first shots fired. The grenades were still in the air when he started firing. Another person described to me how he dived under the pew for cover. Then I heard two grenades explode, he said. I looked up and saw pews sticking up into the air. The firing went on for a while, and then everything was suddenly quiet.
Suddenly I heard explosions going off. My first reaction is that somebody was playing a prank, and that big bang crackers were going off. And so I initially actually stood up and walked in the direction of the door, and then I saw spent cartridges from an automatic rifle, you know, being spewed through the doorway. And of course then I realized what it was. At that point, the first grenade exploded as well. And so I dived down. And I dived down, and of course there was just a second explosion, smoke everywhere, the smell of gunpowder.
I thought of my many friends who were there, and I prayed that they'd be safe. In fact, St. James is the largest evangelical church in Cape Town. It's the most effective evangelistic church in the country. I could only think of the vivid scenes of blood-splattered churches and scenes of massacres in Angola and Mozambique. These scenes flooded back into my mind from the last 11 years of ministering to Christians who have endured such attacks and such atrocities in the areas where we work. As if in sympathy with the storm that was in many of our hearts, lightning flashed across the sky in Cape Town that night, and the heavens wept in a blinding downpour of torrential rain. And above the roar of the rain, the air was filled with wailing sirens from convoys of ambulances, police vehicles, and fire engines as they all converged upon 3rd Avenue, Kenilworth. And the flashing lights and the flashing lightning lit up the scene of dazed survivors fleeing from the church, weeping churchgoers praying in the rain, and frantic relatives searching for loved ones. The tiles in the foyer were smeared with blood. Inside the church, there were several bodies lying on the blood-stained carpets or on shrapnel-scarred pews. Some wooden pews were overturned. There was a hole in the floor where one grenade had exploded. Prayer books, music sheets, welcome cards, and Bibles were strewn amongst the pools of blood. The ceiling was pockmarked with shrapnel. Rescue workers were working swiftly and efficiently. Some of the wounded were being cared for inside the church. Others were being carried out on stretchers to the waiting ambulances. A broken pew was being used to transport one person. Pockets of Christians were sitting, standing, holding hands and praying. The police were moving swiftly but with sensitivity to clear the church sanctuary of all but the emergency personnel. Mr. Lorenzo Smith had his wife Myrtle die in his arms. A piece of shrapnel had pierced her heart. They'd been married for 21 years. She left behind her husband and two children, Craig and Mandy, who weren't hit in attack. Mrs. Marita Ackerman was shot in the chest at close range. She died about 30 minutes after arriving at the hospital. Marita twice triumphed over cancer, and she'd helped start an outreach ministry to a local black town called Khayelitsha, and had also initiated an outreach ministry to Russian seamen who've been passing through the harbour in Cape Town. Marita left behind her husband and three children, Brahm, Liesel and Pierre. She is buried on her birthday. Peter Gordon, who was wounded in the attack, saw his wife Denise murdered next to him. Denise left behind her husband and her little toddler daughter, Sarah. 17-year-old Richard O'Kill died instantly from a bullet through his head as he flung himself across two young friends, Lisa and Bonnie, to shield them from the line of fire. 21-year-old Garrett Archer died instantly as he dived on top of one of the hand grenades. A police spokesman praised the unselfish action of Garrett and said that his action of sacrifice undoubtedly saved the lives of many others by absorbing most of the blast. Garrett's 13-year-old brother Wesley also died in the attack. They left behind their elder brother, 23-year-old Sean, and parents Dennis and Dawn Harker. Four of the slain were Russian sailors. Another victim was Guy Javens. Of those victims who were crippled in the attack at St. James, the most heart-rending situation is that of Ukrainian sailor Dmitry Makagon. Both of his legs were ripped off when one grenade fell in his lap. His right arm had to be amputated, and both his eardrums were burst in a blast. Dmitry was just 23 years old and was earning money as a sailor in order to pay for his wedding upon his return. One medical student, Gillian, narrowly escaped death when a piece of shrapnel pierced her lung and an artery. Her feet were also badly damaged with a bullet straight up one leg. Yet, while lying bleeding on the church floor, she sang a hymn to comfort her uninjured friends. Several survivors expressed their amazement that more people had not been killed, and the police investigators agreed. The M26 fragmentary hand grenades had been attached to tins of nails, 6-inch nails, to provide additional shrapnel. If Herrett had not covered the one grenade with his body, more would have been killed. And if another member of the congregation had not shot back, wounding one of the terrorists, then many more would have been shot as well. After the grenades exploded, one of our workers, Charles, was in the church and happened to be armed at the time, and he returned fire with his little .38 revolver. One bullet wounded the gunman who was firing into the congregation, and the shooting stopped and the attackers withdrew. Charles then pursued the terrorist into the parking lot and fired at the getaway car as it sped off into 3rd Avenue. When the police later recovered the terrorist getaway car, the bloodstained seats indicated that at least one of the gunmen had been seriously injured. And if one compares the St. James massacre with similar atrocities in Zimbabwe, in Mozambique, in Angola and Sudan, it becomes apparent that many more people would have died had that one member of the congregation not shot back. Who could possibly want to attack a congregation of Christians worshipping in a church? And what could anyone hope to accomplish through such senseless slaughter? To these questions, Christians have to add another. How should we as believers respond? And what does it tell us about the future of South Africa? When I saw the shocking carnage at St. James Church, it immediately brought back into my memory similar bloody scenes. Over the last 11 years of missionary work, I've personally come across dozens of similar atrocities, especially in Angola and Mozambique, both communist countries which have relentlessly persecuted the church over the years. In August 1983, Frelimo troops killed 5 pastors and burnt down all 5 churches in Mosquito Village in Zambezia province of Mozambique. In September of 1983, communist troops, Frelimo troops, killed over 50 Christians and burnt down a church in Pasura Village. At Chilisa Evangelical Church in Angola, Cuban troops shot 150 Christians during a church service. At New Adams Farm in Zimbabwe, 16 missionaries and their children were murdered in November 1987. Muslim mobs have burnt down hundreds of churches and killed hundreds of Christians in Nigeria. In the Sudan, more than 100 Christians were crucified earlier this year. Many hundreds of churches have been attacked in Ethiopia over the last 20 years, and there are no more churches left in Somalia. The last church was burnt down, the last minister murdered late last year. And one could continue to recount literally hundreds of similar atrocities. The fact is that churches have often been the target of Muslim extremists and Marxist terrorists. What could anyone hope to accomplish through the attack at St. James? Well, we must note that it is the aim of terrorists to instill fear into the hearts of their target community, to paralyze people into inactivity and into non-resistance, to induce the people to flee the country or at least to be too afraid to fight back. An additional aim could be to provoke an unreasoned or extreme response, to provoke counter-terrorism, which could then be exploited for propaganda purposes. But we must note that the aim of persecution is not to kill Christians. Sending believers to meet their Lord in heaven hardly accomplishes the purposes of evil. No, the aim of persecution is to shock Christians into fear and into inactivity, to paralyze and to neutralize the church. Only if we give in to this fear and allow ourselves to be intimidated into silence and compromise, only then would the enemy achieve his objectives. And this should really encourage us not to betray the faith for which these martyrs have died. The only appropriate response to massacres like this one at St. James is for us to resolve to be even more faithful to Jesus Christ and to his word, the Bible. We dare not allow the fear of man to divert us from fulfilling the Great Commission. What has been particularly disturbing and significant about the St. James massacre and this terrorist attack upon a church congregation is that it has come along with an increasing rise of anti-Christian slogans and a prevalent anti-Christian sentiment amongst the revolutionary movements in South Africa. Just a few weeks after the St. James massacre, nearly 1,000 supporters of the Radical Pan-Africanist Congress, the PAC, marched past the St. James Church chanting, "One Church, One Bomb." As they marched past the mission headquarters of Frontline Fellowship and past the St. James Church, the site of the terrorist attack where 11 Christians had been murdered and 54 injured just a few weeks before, the mob was chanting, "One Settler, One Bullet, One Church, One Bomb." Later, at a rally, a senior PAC official declared in my hearing that he demanded that all missionaries be expelled from the country. And he also demanded that those terrorists who had been arrested for the murder at the St. James Church, that they be unconditionally released from prison. We've noticed increasingly in recent times the use of the slogan, "Kill the pastor, kill the church," at African National Congress and Pan-African Congress rallies. In fact, just this last week, I received a picture from one of our workers of Tony Yengeni, the ANC regional secretary in Johannesburg, marching down the street in Johannesburg under a banner with the slogan, "One Minister, One Bullet." What is particularly disturbing about all this is that the Pan-Africanist Congress, who are credited with the terrorist attack on St. James, and the African National Congress are both allied in a patriotic front. And both the PAC and the ANC have received and continue to receive vast sums of money from the World Council of Churches, from the United Nations, from the European Community, and even from the United States. Yet the PAC and ANC are increasingly turning to witch doctors, many of their marches. Just recently we had a march in Pretoria where a witch, a Sangoma, was actually leading the ANC Women's League on a march in Pretoria to demand women's rights to reproductive freedom, to abortion, and to free state care for working women to be entrenched into the Constitution. This episode and many others have highlighted the pro-abortion and radical feminist nature of the African National Congress, and also demonstrated the increasing role that's been played by witchcraft in the revolution. All too often, one sees the men at the forefront of the violent mobs that have been looting shops and attacking passers-by and stoning vehicles. Many of the men at the forefront of these violent mobs have scars patented into their cheeks, foreheads, or into their chest. These shallow vertical cuts are ceremonially made by witch doctors, who then rub magic potion, or they call it muti, into these incisions. And these scars and rituals are believed to make these men invisible to the security forces or immune to bullets. While many people in the West see the African National Congress of Nelson Mandela and their high-profile leaders as reasonable and as respectable, the reality is far different. Black Christians have pointed out that it is well known that when African National Congress leaders make conciliating statements and calls for reconciliation and calls for peace in English, they're only doing so for the Western media. The crowds, however, ignore all calls made in English. The real message of Mandela and other African National Congress leaders is given in Xhosa, Sotho, or one of the other local languages. I'll give you a few examples. At a rally in King Williamstown, the late Chris Hani led a chant, "We hate de Klerk, we hate capitalists," and he carried on with a litany of hate against every type of section of society. Peter Makaba, the leader of the African National Congress Youth League, has repeatedly led crowds in his famous "Kill the Boer, kill the farmer" chant. On the 12th of August, Makaba urged a crowd in Tembisa to direct the bullets against the president. "I hate him," declared Makaba. He further urged that a local hostel inhabited by Zulus be broken down brick by brick. Later, when he was challenged, Peter Makaba said, "Let me make it clear. What I said was, kill the Boer, kill the farmer, shoot to kill. This is our culture. This is our tradition. Those who disagree can go to hell." The contempt these revolutionaries hold for human life was well expressed also by another quote from the Pan-Africanist Congress Secretary for Defense. Sabelo Farmer recently declared that even if we lose 5 million people out of the 30 million population, then it will be a sacrifice worth making. What concerns many South Africans is that the bloodstained ANC and their PAC allies continue to receive so much diplomatic prestige, so much foreign funding, and so much media prominence from the West. Especially when one considers that the president of the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela, continues to visit and to praise and to enthusiastically support dictators like Fidel Castro of Cuba, Saddam Hussein of Iraq, Colonel Gaddafi of Libya, and terrorist leaders like Yasser Arafat of the PLO. The PAC and the ANC have received and continue to receive vast sums of money from the World Council of Churches, the United Nations, the European Community, and the United States of America. It would be impossible to overemphasize the strategic importance of South Africa to the industrial nations of the West. South Africa contains the world's largest known deposits of gold, platinum, chrome, manganese, vanadium, and fluspar. It also contains substantial deposits of antimony, asbestos, copper, diamonds, iron ore, lead, phosphate, titanium, uranium, and other strategic minerals. South Africa has the largest strategic mineral deposits in the world. Without these vital minerals, America could not manufacture air conditioners, refrigerators, motor vehicles, or even jet aircraft. Not only is South Africa of vital importance to the West in terms of minerals, but also in terms of its maritime position. South Africa sits astride the Cape Sea Route, which is the busiest sea route in the world. More than 26,000 ships sail past South Africa every year. More than 30% of all the United States oil imports and 50% of Western Europe's oil and 25% of Western Europe's food supplies all travel around the strategic sea route that goes around the Cape of Good Hope of South Africa. Not only is South Africa of great importance in terms of strategic minerals and its maritime position, but in terms of its military power. The South African Defence Force has proven itself to be the superpower of Africa. The South African Defence Forces carried out one of the most successful counterinsurgency operations in history against the Soviet-backed SWAPO terrorists in Southwest Africa, and for 26 years it defeated that Soviet-backed terrorist invasion. The South African Defence Force blunted the southward advance of the Soviet expansionism in Africa, and for 15 years we faced the best Cuban, Soviet and East German weaponry and personnel in conventional warfare in Angola, and we defeated them every time. it would not be to the West interests for the highly advanced, battle-tested South African weaponry to fall into the hands of the international terrorist network. Not only is South Africa of great importance in terms of its strategic minerals, its maritime position, and its military, but also in a spiritual sense, South Africa is the most important missionary-sending nation in the Southern Hemisphere. The South African churches form the main missionary base for all of Africa. South Africa is one of the most important bases for gospel radio broadcasts in Africa, and for Bible translation, and for Bible production. South Africa, in fact, produces more Bibles in more languages than any other nation on the face of the earth. In recent years, South Africa has sent thousands of missionaries to Asia, Africa, Europe, and South America. For decades, state schools in South Africa have begun each day with Bible reading and prayer. Evangelical religious instruction with a stated aim of bringing every child to a personal knowledge of Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior has been part of the syllabus of our public schools, and creation has been taught in the classrooms. Laws have protected South Africa from the evils of pornography, from homosexuality and abortion, and Sunday trading has always been curtailed and cinemas have been closed in honor of the Lord's Day. Yet all these things are now under attack. As the missionary sending base, South Africa is being seriously undermined, and South Africa today is being flooded with imported filth at an alarming rate. Seemingly from every side, especially from the mass media, pornography and abortion are being glamorized, promoted, and forced upon us. When considered along with the 30 years of terrorist attacks, international sanctions, boycotts, and economic sabotage, these assaults represent an overwhelming threat to the future of Christian civilization in Southern Africa. For decades, though, South Africa has been the target of an unprecedented international campaign of media propaganda, of economic warfare, and of revolutionary violence. For decades, South Africa has been slandered by an extraordinary media campaign of deception and distortion, of bias and brainwashing, of propaganda and prejudice. Ignoring the 100 violent revolutions that have occurred in Africa since 1956, ignoring the 45 civil wars that have occurred in Africa since 1956, ignoring the 49 dictatorships of Africa, the international media has zeroed in an obsession with South Africa out of all proportion to its coverage of the other 54 countries of Africa. Instead of using the wide-angle lens of context, most journalists reporting on South Africa seem to have preferred the zoom lens of selective reporting. The opinion of criminals were repeated, while those of their victims were forgotten. Peace accords enjoyed prominent headlines, while violations were tucked away in small print. The promises of the socialists received much attention, while their atrocities barely merited passing mention. The agenda of the revolutionaries dominated the headlines, whilst the concerns of the law-abiding were disregarded. Radicals were often quoted, while the moderates were more often misquoted. Unproven allegations of police misconduct were screamed in banner headlines, while the overwhelming evidence of widespread atrocities by the ANC revolutionaries were scarcely whispered. The odd exceptional overreaction by the police received the full focus of media attention, while an ongoing systematic pattern of terrorism by the ANC was ignored. Even more seriously, vital information that could have enabled overseas viewers or readers to understand the complex situation in South Africa was left unreported. Most reports seem to be distorted to fit the preconceived notion and perception that the strife in South Africa is racial, that the root problem is apartheid, that the war is between the white oppressors and the black oppressed, and any reports that could not be contorted to conform to that formula were seemingly discarded. What has particularly concerned South Africans is how our complex situation has been routinely oversimplified. 30-second sound bites are hardly adequate to communicate accurately the conflict raging in South Africa. Slogans, cliches, parrot cries, and predictable stock phrases don't enlighten anyone. Even more seriously, much of the reporting on South Africa is downright dishonest. Now, two sides to any story. Let me give you some of the other side of the situation in South Africa. Some of the untold story of South Africa includes the fact that millions of black refugees, migrant workers and illegal immigrants have fled into South Africa from neighboring black states. In fact, most of the black people in South Africa were born in other countries. And far from being a black civil rights group, the African National Congress, the ANC, has actually been a vicious revolutionary movement controlled by white communists such as the KGB Colonel Joe Slova. Neither does the ANC represent all the black people of South Africa. Despite dominating the media and its massive foreign funding, the ANC has failed to sign up more than 500,000 members. By way of contrast, the Inkatha Freedom Party of Dr. Mangosuthu Buthelezi has over 2.5 million paid up members. And even though they've got 5 times more members than the ANC, they don't even seem to get 1/5 of the coverage, and most of the coverage they get in the media is negative. Few people in the West realize that most of the South African police force and most of the South African defense force are black, and a large amount of the terrorists and leaders of the African National Congress are white. The violence in South Africa has very little to do with racial strife. In fact, almost all the violence in South Africa is an ideological conflict. It is black and white together against the Reds. In fact, it would increasingly be more accurate to describe the war in South Africa as a religious war, one between two opposing religious views, that of communism and Christianity. This is the reason why the African National Congress Regional Secretary Tony Ngeni could march in Johannesburg just last week under the slogan, "One Minister, One Bullet." This is why the Pan-Africanist Congress could introduce the chant, "One Church, One Bomb." This is why so many of the ANC and PAC radicals are chanting the slogan, "Kill the pastor, kill the church." The anti-Christian nature of this war is made quite clear by the Pan-Africanist Congress when it demands that all missionaries must be expelled from the country. The satanic and occultic aspect of this warfare is made even more clear by the way how witch doctors and Satanists and witches regularly lead the marches of the African National Congress and the Pan-Africanist Congress. This is why so many times after the ANC or PAC have marched, churches are set on fire and destroyed on the same day. Literally hundreds of churches have been attacked with firebombs and damaged or destroyed by firebombs in recent years. The future of Christian civilization in Southern Africa is in jeopardy. As South Africa reels from the effects of hundreds of massacres and daily terrorist atrocities, civil war now seems unavoidable. The culminative effect of decades of terrorist attacks, international sanctions, boycotts, economic sabotage, and a relentless media war have undermined the entire social fabric. South Africa now faces the options of either surrendering to the totalitarian aims of the ANC Southern Communist Party Alliance, or resisting, leading to maybe secession and a probable Yugoslav-type civil war, or third option being partition, to redraw the map to accommodate the conflicting demands of the various alliances. The question that comes before us now is, how did it ever come to this? That Christians could be shot down and blown apart by terrorists within the sanctuary of their own churches during a service? How is it that terrorists could be funded by the World Council of Churches and by the United Nations and the European Community? How is it that South Africa has got to this tragic situation where it has to choose between communism or civil war, between surrender or secession, between paganism or partition, between Christianity or communism? The choice before us is now revival or revolution, Christ or chaos. How did it come to this? What is the background to the crisis that now confronts South Africa?
Peter, you've certainly given us a wealth of information. You've concisely framed the problem. Now we'll expect to find some answers on side two. Please listen to the other side of this tape now.
In my short lifetime, I've seen one country after another targeted by ruthless revolutionaries and then attacked by a combination of Soviet-trained terrorists, communist subversion, and Western economic sanctions. When I was born, 1960, Africa was a paradise, peaceful and stable. The people were well fed and many African states exported food. Yet, over the last 30 years, I've seen several countries attacked by terrorism betrayed by the West, and destroyed by corruption and socialism. While I was brought up in Rhodesia, what is today communist Zimbabwe, refugees were fleeing from the carnage in the Congo. Fellow schoolchildren related to me how the United Nations troops, Indians, Moroccans, Swedes and others, had looted their homes, had raped their mothers, and murdered people in front of them. Now, my favorite film at that time was The Man from U.N.C.L.E. According to The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the United Nations were the good guys, and in a kind of pre-Glasnost situation back then, 1960s, we had a Russian secret agent and an American secret agent working together in the United Nations to preserve world peace. Well, according to the movie screen, the United Nations were the good guys, but according to fellow school children in the desk next to me, the United Nations were actually the bad guys. Some told how local hospitals had been bombed by the United Nations aircraft. Others had seen their parents murdered by the Simba terrorists. Only later did I read The Fearful Master and another book, Out of the Jaws of the Lion, and come to understand something of what had happened in the Belgian Congo, which today has been renamed Zaire. How the United Nations destroyed the democratic state of Katanga and forced that mineral-rich pro-Western country to rejoin the chaotic, communist-infiltrated Congo. Soon, it was our own turn, as Rhodesia, which today is Marxist Zimbabwe, was targeted. For school outings and picnics, I remember how we often travelled on roads endangered by landmines and ambushes, and how our teachers were armed with machine guns. Farmhouses of friends were rocketed and mortared. Whole families were blown up by landmines while travelling on farm roads. In some cases, parents woke up to an explosion, only to run into their children's room and see their baby blown up from a Soviet RPG rocket that had been fired through the wall into the nursery. Entire schools were abducted by terrorists and forced across the border into guerrilla training camps in Mozambique or Zambia. Missionaries were massacred, and civilian airliners were shot down, often with the survivors being murdered at the same time. Now, Rhodesia had been a faithful ally of the United States and of Britain in the First World War and in the Second World War, also in Malaya. Yet, in our hour of need, we were not only not helped, but Rhodesia was sanctioned, embargoed, boycotted, slandered, and betrayed by the Commonwealth, by the United Nations, by the United States, and by Britain. As the Rhodesian Prime Minister Ian Smith told me, we were never beaten by our enemies, we were betrayed by our friends. The Rhodesian army won all the battles on the field, only to see the politicians give away the country at the negotiation table of Lancaster House in 1979. Although my elder brother Derek had fought in the Rhodesian army and I in the Southwest in the South African Defence Force, we both faced a similar enemy and we encountered the same terrorist tactics. In Southwest Africa, which now has been renamed Namibia, I witnessed whole villages burnt to the ground, vehicles mangled by landmine explosions, and tribesmen mutilated by SWAPO terrorists. I spoke with terrorists who we had captured, who claimed to have been recruited by their World Council of Churches affiliated Swedish Lutheran minister. Time and again we found reminders of the fact that the terrorists who we were fighting were supported by the World Council of Churches. In terrorist camps, I've seen how all their weapons were Soviet bloc AK-47s, SKS rifles, RPG rocket launchers, RPD machine guns, Makarov and Tokarov pistols, 12.7mm and 14.5mm anti-aircraft guns, 122mm rocket launchers, and countless tons of PMN anti-personnel mines, those designed to blow off your foot, and TM-57 landmines designed to take out an entire truck or even a tank. Yet the food and the medicines in these terrorist camps were almost always from the West. Tinned Danish sardines, Norwegian pilchards, sacks of corn with a US shield stamped on them, gift of the people of the United States of America, I remember reading. Crates from the Lutheran World Federation or the International Red Cross or UNESCO. All too often we were reminded that the World Council of Churches supported the SWAPO terrorists just as they had financed the Frelimo communists in Mozambique, the MPLA communist guerrillas in Angola, the ZANU and ZAPU communist terrorists in Zimbabwe, and as they continue to support the communist ANC and Pan-Africanist Congress in South Africa today. We also won all our battles in Southwest Africa. The South African Defence Force was never beaten. By 1989, Southwest Africa was peaceful and stable, and Swapo was beaten. How then did the politicians snatch defeat from the jaws of victory? We had crippled the Cuban colonialists in Angola. We had beaten back the Soviet and East German-led assaults, and we had restored law and order to the border regions of Southwest Africa. Yet, while our soldiers won the battles against unbelievable odds often, the politicians inexplicably lost the war. Again, the soldiers won the battles, but the politicians gave away the country. As a missionary to the war zones of Africa over the last 11 years, I've also researched the ongoing persecution of the church in Mozambique and in Angola. Both of these countries used to be Portuguese colonies. In 1975, after a socialist revolution in Portugal, both Mozambique and Angola were handed over to communist terrorist movements without even an election or a referendum. Inside Mozambique, I've witnessed jet fighters swooping down and rocketing and shooting up villages in Mozambique. Yet, I noticed that those poor primitive people living in those mud huts with thatched roofs, they didn't even have a chance. There was not even any military equipment in these villages. There was no reason at all for this senseless act of carnage. Yet, what angered me even more was when I noticed that those jets were British-built jets of the Zimbabwe Air Force. The British Military Assistance Training Team, BMAT, trained the Zimbabwe pilots and the military forces of communist Mozambique, of Zambia, Zimbabwe and Botswana, all of whom were hosting ANC terrorist bases against South Africa. And the European Community and the United States of America, along with North Korea, East Germany, Libya and the Soviet Union, all together aided these countries, these communist countries, with hundreds of millions of dollars annually, even while they were murdering their own people with this weaponry. I have personally seen hundreds of burnt out and desecrated churches. It would be no exaggeration for me to say I've walked through over 100 destroyed villages and seen the remains of dozens of massacres in Mozambique and Angola. I've spoken to hundreds of survivors and ministered to the relatives of those martyrs who died for their faith in Christ. I've seen also how Western newspapers regularly fail to report these atrocities, or they neglected to correctly attribute these atrocities to the Marxist regimes responsible. Worse still, most editors slandered the pro-Western resistance movements of RENAMO or UNITA and blamed these anti-communist freedom movements for the actions of the Marxists. And this is the problem we now face in South Africa. Most Americans and Europeans are only seeing South Africa through the journalists' zoom lens of selective reporting. But what is needed is for the outsiders to step back and use the wide-angle lens of the broader context. South Africa is an African country, and it needs to be evaluated in the context of African standards, not American or European double standards. South Africa is also a country at war, and therefore it is unfair to use peacetime standards to judge our country. It is also blatant disinformation to oversimplify the complexities of South Africa and brand our conflict a racial one. It's also ridiculous to blame all of our problems on apartheid. First of all, most of the Southern police are black, many of the ANC terrorists are white, and thousands of black people pour into South Africa every day. Most of the black people in South Africa were not born there. Most are immigrants and migrant workers and refugees. A large proportion of the South African army are black. Americans need to ask, why have so many Africans voted with their feet for South Africa? Perhaps it's because most of the rest of Africa is a basket case of man-made famines, of intertribal warfare, corruption, and incompetence. South Africa, by way of contrast, has provided the highest standards of living for black people on the entire continent of Africa. Blacks in South Africa have enjoyed the highest standards of medicine, education, transport and business. There are more black millionaires in South Africa than in the rest of the continent put together. Yet US film crews can visit South Africa and select some squatter camps of refugees and present that exceptional poverty as normative for black people throughout the country. Many overseas critics charge that the whites in South Africa exploit the blacks and oppress them and keep them poor. That is a blatant lie. Most of Africa lies in abject poverty. What causes the poverty outside of South Africa? Near Cape Town, we have an entire city of four towns called Khayelitsha, which has been constructed since 1983, just to accommodate illegal immigrants and squatters. Of the 650,000 Khoisa tribesmen now living in Khayelitsha, over 98% came from the independent states of Transkei and Ciskei. The white taxpayers of Cape Town have spent over $1 billion, over $1 billion in the last 9 years to build up the schools, shopping centers, hospitals, teacher training college, library, and tens of thousands of heavily subsidized houses. The government makes houses available for $200 deposit or $30 a month rent, plumbing, electricity, roads, railways, bridges, parks, and a major seaside resort and an entertainment center have all been provided for these uninvited foreign guests. All of it paid for by the local white taxpayers of Cape Town. The trouble is, it is just not reasonable for overseas armchair critics to expect 4.5 million whites to turbo boost some 30 million relatively primitive third world people into 1990s first world standards of lifestyle. The largely white taxpayers of South Africa have provided subsidized housing, plumbing, electricity, transport services, free education and healthcare for the black people of South Africa. And despite our many sins, we in South Africa provide most of the electricity, most of the food, consumer goods, railway carriages and technology for our generally hostile neighboring states. Although Namibia and Zimbabwe and Botswana and Mozambique all harbour and support ANC terrorist bases who come over the border and plant bombs in our country and assassinate our people, yet despite the fact that Namibia, Zimbabwe, Botswana and Mozambique, these hostile neighbours spread hatred against us through the media, they eat our meat and our corn, we transport almost all of their imports and exports for them, we Russian relief aid regularly, we rescue their people when natural disasters strike. We provide the best medical care in Africa for their people. We regularly fly in medicines, snake bite serums, and livestock vaccinations to them. We repair, service, and maintain the aircraft. We repair their bridges. We loan them most of their locomotives and aircraft. Actions speak louder than words. What does seem particularly unfair, though, is that the radicals make more and more unrealistic demands upon the taxpayers while engaging in mass economic sabotage, boycotts, strikes, stayaways, and riots. In order to keep pace with the black population explosion and immigration wave, South Africa now needs to build about 168 classrooms a week, 1.6 million housing units immediately, a new house every 60 seconds, and create a new job every 70 seconds. Yet rioters have destroyed over $6 billion worth of buildings and vehicles just in recent months. And African National Congress intimidation has enforced rent boycotts that have cost the taxpayer over another $6 billion in lost revenues. The loss to the Soweto Town Council alone exceeds $500 million. In this context, it also seems unreasonable for America to condemn South Africa's efforts to uplift its black neighbors economically while maintaining economic sanctions, boycotts, and disinvestment on our beleaguered country. United States sanctions have cost South Africa over 2 million jobs and $4 billion worth of capital investment. That damage is equal to about 4 full years of gold production. Today we have about 9 million unemployed people in our country out of a total population of just over 30 million. Many South Africans question what moral basis our Western allies have for criticizing and sanctioning South Africa. South Africa has been the target of the most sustained international psychological warfare campaign in the history of the world. We have been overwhelmed by the onslaught of hatred and lies. We have been victimized to the point where South Africans could not even attend the Olympic Games in Seoul, South Korea, not even as spectators. To think that South African airmen are buried in Seoul. We were good enough to die to free Korea from communism in the 1950s, but not to attend the Olympics. Are sanctions and boycotts consistent with loving your neighbor? So now, we see South Africa beginning to crumble after decades of sports boycotts, media bias, terrorism and sanctions. Since South Africa bowed to US and Western pressure to release Mandela and to unban the ANC in 1990, since the release of Mandela and unbanning of the ANC, over 60,000 people have been murdered. Now a tidal wave of crime and violence is threatening to drown civilization in South Africa. Most friends and families that I know have been affected. One black girl I know had her parents shot dead in front of her, and she is paralyzed by the same AK-47 that murdered her loved ones. Another black man had his home and business burned to the ground and regularly contacts us for help just to survive. The brother of a good friend of mine was shot dead in his car at a stop sign. The murderer who shot him had just been released from prison, and the general amnesty that was given to over 50,000 convicted criminals, including rapists, murderers, and bombers, who had been released at the insistence of the West. My brother's home was burgled 10 times, and his home was attacked by terrorists in the middle of the night. My vehicles have been broken into several times. Another woman I know saw her husband and 5 children all burnt to death by the brutal ANC necklace. Yet, the leader of the ANC, Nelson Mandela, could visit America and be received like the Messiah. How could the US president shake the hands of a terrorist leader who openly supported Saddam Hussein, who continues to support Saddam Hussein, Fidel Castro, Yasser Arafat, and Gaddafi? The ANC declares its solidarity with the IRA terrorists of Northern Ireland and the PLO terrorists. The ANC has planted landmines in farm roads and car bombs in public streets and limpet mines in restaurants and shopping centers. What could be clearer than that? As one of my friends in Angola put it, it's better to be America's enemy than to be America's friend. If you are America's enemy, then you may be bought. But if you are her friend, then you will certainly be sold. United States foreign policy now seems to be abandon our friends, appease our enemies. It hurts me to say it. I love the American Christians. You are good people. I appreciate American history. I avidly read American books. I'm married to an American. We have so much in common. Both South Africa and America were founded in the 1400s, settled by pilgrims in the 1600s, settled by similar God-fearing pioneers. There are so many parallels in our histories, and we share a similar missionary calling. But these are troubled and treacherous days, and our hope must only be in the Lord, for He alone is mighty, all-knowing, and everywhere present. We need to get back to the Bible to learn God's word and to do His will. We need to pray for revival and reformation both in South Africa and in America. We need to be informed, because as the violence is continuing to escalate rapidly in South Africa, many military and intelligence sources are predicting a full-scale civil war in our country. Intelligence analysts that I'm in touch with point out that Western sanctions have had a catastrophic impact upon South Africa's economy. The cumulative effect of sabotaging the economic foundations of South Africa and of supporting the revolutionary ANC Southern Communist Party alliance is that unemployment and an unprecedented explosion of crime and violence are threatening to undermine the entire social fabric. With every new atrocity and every new unreasonable demand, the polarization of South Africa into irreconcilable armed camps becomes more and more ominous. At the time of this taping, South Africa's options seem to be threefold. We either need to surrender to the totalitarian aims of the ANC, PAC, South African Communist Party alliance, in which case South Africa will become a unitary socialist state which will degenerate into the totalitarianism that we have seen destroy the countries of Eastern Europe and Mozambique and Angola. Secondly, we can resist and try and have secession where parts of the country can break away, just as Croatia and Slovenia try to break away from communist Yugoslavia. And the result of that could be a probable Yugoslav-type civil war. It is in this particular scenario that we are deeply concerned. Many South Africans have expressed the fear to me that, in fact, the United States of America would get involved in a civil war in South Africa by invading South Africa to help prop up an ANC government or to help install it, should we be able to thwart their attempts to seize power. It would break my heart to see our friends in America having to take part in a United Nations invasion of South Africa. And I plead with you, my friends and brothers and sisters in Christ in America, to resist this attempt at all costs. Why is it that the media is so continually biased against South Africa? Is it religious prejudice? Is it because South Africa has pro-life legislation protecting the right to life of pre-born babies that leads pro-choice editors to trash South Africa? Is it because our schools begin in prayer and make Bible education creation in the curriculum a part of our schools that makes humanists foam at the mouth against our country? And why do the Zulus get so much negative press? Could it be because Dr. Buthelezi, the elected Prime Minister of the Zulus, is a Christian? Could that explain the media bias against him? Could the Christian revival amongst the Zulus explain why they are being blamed for the violence and being vilified in the press? And why is the ANC so popular in the West media? Is it because the ANC supports socialist redistribution of wealth? the nationalization of industries and banks, the legalization of abortion and pornography. The ANC supports these things. The ANC not only supports the legalization of pornography and abortion, it also supports the protection of homosexual rights and the removal of the Bibles from South African schools. Is this what the West wants for South Africa?